Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Listeners, Greg here for a quick prologue. I already knew back when Toby and I first recorded this that it was going to be a difficult conversation, even at the time when coronavirus and people's reactions to it was the only issue we were dealing with. We recorded on May 9th, and then on May 25th, police murdered George Floyd. I started editing this episode in earnest on September 1st, several days after the Jacob Blake shooting, and a scant 3 days after the death of Chadwick Boseman from cancer. Already having decided to put our retrospective of the Cartographer's Handbook on the back burner, I pondered the idea of waiting to do this edit as well. I still have our interview with Matt Wardle to share, and that should be a rollicking good time for all when it comes out. But it's also true that the longer I wait to put these regular episodes out, the longer it will take to release our retrospective on Tiger's Eye, which Toby and I will be recording our first episode on tomorrow. Therefore, I am going to try and press forward. After all, this story is about more than just the social and racial issues, and I shouldn't be afraid to do my best to address them. I hold myself to account for doing the work, and using my compassion and anger the best I can to address the serious issues facing this country. Sadly, the issues that have been facing this country for a long time and now threaten to overwhelm it. So I am sorry if this episode is less fun than some that have come before. And although it feels like I keep saying this, I also hope it helps all of you during these dark times. Hello and welcome back, listeners. This is Through the Wind Door with your friends Greg and Toby, and we are here for the first time to discuss a single chapter of New Century, specifically Chapter 13 of Secret Rooms. We assume that you've read it at this point, or listened to it, as the case may be, so you already know why this is going to be a heavy subject to tackle.
One to take our time on.
I laugh now, but it's important to be clear, these are all serious topics, because they delve not just into issues that are still issues today, but there is going to be some discussion that is going to delve into current events. We understand that you are getting into fictional worlds of various kinds, whether we're talking about movies, books, TV shows, video games, probably as a way to escape the onslaught that is happening on an emotional and physical and health level on pretty much all over the world, but especially in places like America and the UK, where this is not being handled the best. And so therefore, it's hard to talk about some of the things that come up in Secret Rooms in this chapter that have resonance with current events. So we are going to do our best to speak about this stuff intelligently and with empathy. And I can't say that there isn't going to be some humor input into this, even if it's black humor. Maybe there's just going to be some nervous laughter. This isn't going to be easy. But if we wanted things to be easy, we wouldn't have decided to talk about these things, because it's not like we're discussing something like The Good Place, where it has a foundation of psychology, but is primarily a comedy show. This is not to say that The Good Place doesn't mention serious topics either, but it comes at it from a wide-angle lens rather than drilling down. If it does make pointed comments, it does so in brief before moving on. Comedy, of course, is also the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down.
secret rooms works particularly well as something that relates to the modern day, in that it's very much a case of people reacting, even though it's 10 years after the Wendigos have appeared, because it's our first book in a sort of post-Wendigo world. It is kind of like we are seeing the first response or the first actions that humanity is taking in the response to these circumstances. So it does mean that we face certain like human responses, political responses, all the things which kind of feel like they tie into the reality that we know and helps us understand this world, because we can go, oh yeah, that is sort of what I would imagine would happen. And in some circumstances, that's a good thing. If you see a character reacting in an uplifting way where you think, yeah, I would like to think that people would have that compassion. And in other instances, it's not a good thing. And you go, yeah, that does seem like something I could imagine happening.
Anyway, the point of a fan podcast is to generate discussion. We're going to have discussion, me and Toby, today. But if it encourages you to want to be able to have your own conversations, either with us or with other people, you know, then at the very least, we hope they're good discussions. Before we get into the seriousness of what is happening in this chapter, let me say, this is actually a very important moment, because at time of recording, Through the Wind Door has actually finally come online. I had actually completely forgotten this. Toby and I had our first Skype conversation on February 23rd, 2020. 2.5 months later, and into recording our 10th episode, Through the Wind Door was finally more than just Toby and I nattering at each other through the internet. I am going to stop being embarrassed how long it took me to get my shit together, and just be glad to have gotten this far, to have impacted Alex, Sharon, Theo, Loretta, and Matt along the way, and our small audience that download the newest episode pretty speedily after I release it. Yes, it took me a long time just to get to a point where I felt comfortable sitting down, listening to everything that we had done, and trying to turn it into a shape that I felt comfortable putting it out into the world. It took me longer than I wanted to.
It's all right. Everyone has that moment of, okay, now to listen to hours of my own voice. This was a terrible mistake. Whenever they start a new podcast.
Yeah. But the response has already been very positive, and I thank everybody that has taken a chance on listening to us natter on for close to 2 hours in our first episode, and I can assure you that it's only going to get better from here. I think we're getting tighter talking about these things. I think that I'm only increasing in leaps and bounds my ability to both edit out the cruft and edit in the good stuff to help the podcast come alive, much like the kind of thing that Alex does every day with School of Movies and New Century. So here's to our first success and many more to come.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Something we've gotten away from in the last few episodes is we had not really gone in and done a synopsis of the stuff that happened previous chapters. We've been pretty much diving right into the things that we wanted to talk about. I feel like that may be something we get back into, or it may not, because it's not like we necessarily have less to talk about. And I feel it helps keep individual topics more sequestered to their own portion of the podcast.
This will actually be one of the last times we do a synopsis, as the happy medium I eventually settled on was to write our talking points in as much of a chronological order as possible. The entire point of the podcast is not to tell you the story of New Century. Our listeners either recently read these chapters or know the story by heart, and don't need us to do a blow-by-blow. This isn't like School of Movies, where sometimes Alex and Sharon need to explain what happened because you haven't seen the movie and should, or haven't seen the movie and really shouldn't.
But in this case, let me just give a brief rundown of what happens in Chapter 13, because it will be very brief. Our heroes, Abigail, James, and Annie, come to have a final conversation with Mary Sampson because they find out that almost half of all the gathered people of New Athens are apparently going to be moving on rather than joining the RSA. And more than that, they are specifically going to try to move west.
And the reason why this moment is concerning is another one of those parts of the cartographer's handbook that is referred to without going into detail. The handbook basically says outright that the Pan-State line will be guarded, as the needs of the RSA are such that they cannot afford to have able-bodied people just leave to try their luck in uncontrolled wilderness. The handbook does not say what will happen, but the implication is that force will be used to prevent people from crossing that border. What the handbook does say is that those who will not join the RSA are to be considered secessionists, and that secession that cannot be resolved with fair negotiation must be met with swift, unyielding force until it, like the Wendigo, is eradicated.
It's very deliberate wording, considering that the most recent organized war against human opponents was of the Civil War, and secessionists would have been a very loaded term that the United States of America would have known as, oh, secessionists, they're enemies, in the same sort of way that you would refer to someone as a filthy commie if they were, like, you know, you were in the Cold War. It's just it's synonymous with you're an enemy of our sort of country. And I think that it would, for the Southerners who would have been on the other side of that, would know, oh, okay, so you're going to see us like that, are you? So it is a very carefully selected word, I think.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the people leaving under Mary Sampson probably did react very strongly to it. They have decided, this group under Mary Sampson, that they are going to go into the West and find out for certain what's going to happen. And the conversation that they end up having is, you know, are you really willing to risk your lives doing this? And talking, therefore, about the pros and cons of this. Unfortunately, Abigail is not able to change Mary's mind. And they are left with now talking with the remaining leader of the remaining people, Mayor Buck, who seems more than happy to set his cap to the tune of the Unified States, even as it is made more and more clear that his way of thinking is not necessarily aligned with the thinking of our heroes or their spokesperson for the RSA, Thomas Arlington. So the chapter is bracketed by those two conversations, followed up with a return by Abigail to her family home, a personal moment where she takes a few mementos and then leaves that part of her life behind, basically trying to heal over as much as she can of that still open wound because she doesn't know what happens to her mother and father. She goes and has a conversation with Annie where she acknowledges just how difficult this is and that she has a greater appreciation now for what Annie has to do on a regular basis, and that is how the chapter closes.
Having listened to the recap of the synopsis, I am reminded for the first time of a similar story that resonates with this encounter, a first season episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine titled Progress. It centers around Major Kira Nerys, who is a former freedom fighter that is now a part of her people's military, and currently tasked with making sure settlers of a local moon are evacuated before it is used to create a source of renewable power for the planet it orbits. She comes up against an old man that is just as hard-headed as she is, who refuses to evacuate even if it means his life, and she does her best to ingratiate herself with this old man in an attempt to convince him. At the same time, she is running up against her old feelings of rebellion during a time of oppression, and she needs the Starfleet captain to come down and remind her that she is now part of a better system instead of fighting against a corrupt one, and the goals of her new government are actually for the benefit of all. There are definite parallels here where Abigail doesn't feel right about denying someone else's agency. And one could even go so far as to say this is why she had Annie read the handbook for the people of New Athens the night before. She is not fully on board with the new order, and she may have suspected it would show if she tried to read Arlington's words.
Loyalty mission complete.
Right. We made a reference to the Mass Effect loyalty mission last time.
I'm sorry, listeners. Those will continue.
I mean, I get the feeling overall, like most of the fans of New Century are massive geeks, and so therefore don't need this sort of thing explained to them. There are going to be perhaps new people along the way that do not have the same frame of reference, but it's fine. We explained that last time. As already established, we're going to need to have a little bit of levity on the way before diving into the darkness of people's unwise responses to things. So let's get right to it. Some of the topics that we were originally going to want to discuss today, I think we are going to keep sequestered to their own chapter, because one of the big topics is race relations, and it actually goes very smoothly on some levels from the stuff that gets brought up in this chapter to the stuff that gets brought up in the following chapter, The Painted Wall, because that is the first chapter that brings us back into the flashback of Abigail and James and their experiences as children in Weirwood. There's racial stuff there, and in some ways it's more intense than what just happens in this chapter alone, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. If you've already gone ahead and read, because we've slowed things down here to, for the first time, just talk about one chapter, and you may already be ahead of us at this point. All right, let us proceed. Abigail and Mary and their conversation. Toby, do you want to start us off, or should I just start with point number one?
Boy, we just sound enthused to tackle these subjects, don't we? And this is after I edit out the long silences and sighing.
Well, I think that the conversation between Abigail and Mary is this, like, you already know that it's going to be important because it's Annie sort of leads the way and frames it as this big moment, this proving point for Abigail. And I think just Abigail going into it thinking, well, this is just peachy, because she knows that she is probably woefully ill-equipped to handle this, but I think that she wants to give it a go, even if she has her own protestations, because what's important to Abigail when Mary says, we don't feel welcome here anymore, and Abigail says, of course you're welcome here, that has extra significance, because this was the town she grew up in beforehand, and if it was any other soldier saying it, it could be a bit hollow. But for her, it's a bit like when she has the conversation with the family who are living in her home at the end. She gives them her blessing. She has no qualms with other people living in the home that she once knew. So it becomes this wider thing, but I think it establishes this humanizing personal connection between the two when beforehand there wasn't that, because they hadn't had a conversation before this, it becomes this personal connection. But then it becomes very loaded when Abigail tries a sort of Hail Mary approach where she thinks, okay, I'm going to say this thing, which is probably I shouldn't be, but I think it might make a difference. I mentioned in my notes I sent your way that Abigail, I think one of her strengths as a diplomat that she shows here, and even at this early stage in her career as a cartographer, is that she allows herself to be very human and to show her sort of fallibility and her vulnerability as a human and not just this regimented soldier, this wall. In the same way, in the way that Annie, like, is very charming, but she does show that she has this flourish of talent where she's able to hit a target at 100 meters or however much it is. Abigail doesn't do that. She doesn't flex, so to speak. She will actually sit down and have a conversation with you. But that's a double-edged sword, because by sharing the side of her, this sort of open humanity of herself, it actually means that she kind of shows how little world experience she has, because she thinks, okay, I'm going to try and make a personal connection with Mary, because if I say that Arlington, the person who wrote the book or is organizing all of this and is trying his best to make things better, is also a Black American, it may help her feel like this person may not be entirely sort of holding her interests counter to her own. And it creates this moment, and I love Maureen Foley's delivery as Mary Sampson, when after she relays this information, she says,
"And?"
The words on the page make it sound like she is saying, is bewildered and is not sure what her point is, but she knows exactly what her point is. But it's important to her that Abigail says what the rest of her point is, so that she can kind of hear the words come out of her own mouth and say, well, maybe you might have something in common. And it's just this moment of, oh no, I've just put my foot in it. What works very well about this conversation between the two characters is this opportunity for characterization for both individuals, because you see that Abigail really is kind of out of her element, but she's not going about it in entirely the wrong way. Being human, putting herself out there, does establish a connection, and I don't think that counts for nothing. I think that the fact that the very last words of this conversation is Mary saying sincerely, no, we don't need your help, but thank you anyway. It is this moment where she does actually sort of acknowledge what Abigail's good intentions are. But I think it is also an indication of how much she has left to grow as someone who hasn't seen a lot of the world before now.
All right, you just threw everything at the wall there. And I'm not saying that that was necessarily a bad idea. I very often do the same thing where I have so many thoughts that I just speak all of them and just blah, just put it out into the world.
And that was a point salad, wasn't it? Just like, let's put everything that we could possibly talk about this into one mishmash.
Let me try parsing out some of the stuff that you covered there.
Please do.
First of all, well, not necessarily first of all, I'm actually not going to do these in order, because the first thing I wanted to cover is something that you ran over the top of and I feel specifically needs to be highlighted better. It's something that I've had a chance to personally experience through conversations online, usually through Twitter, but through other mediums as well. So the point during the conversation where Abigail is revealing to Mary that the man that wrote this handbook and is in charge of the rebuilding of the United States is a Black man and a former slave, it's basically a conversational tactic. And that's actually the first mistake. Sincerity and honesty was working for Abigail, but Sampson could sense when she devolved into tactical thinking. The problem here is that it's actually a very common thing, particularly for white people, to invoke the voice of a Black person, most often Black leaders and celebrities, but people will also try to utilize the words of Black friends if applicable, in order to convince another Black person, basically implying that because they are both Black, that they should automatically be in concert with each other. That's not something that any group would approve of, no matter what that group is. It's not quite the same as someone suggesting that all Jews are good with money, or that all Asians are good at math. But it is suggesting that because someone is a part of a group, that they should all be in agreement about something.
And as someone that is a part of the LGBTQ spectrum and has had the chance to experience more than a few conversations about who should even be even included under that umbrella, I can attest to the fact that this is not only a pretty big fallacy, it's also an insult in the wrong context. It gets particularly problematic when white people try to weaponize the words of black leaders, most recently relevant in regards to attempts to use the words of Martin Luther King to suggest the right way to protest. Because, let's face it, people that invoke the voices of black leaders, particularly Martin Luther King, are not always giving good faith arguments. And so even when someone that we believe in the sincerity of and believe in the empathy of and believe in the overall goodness of, like Abigail, when she uses a tactic like that, it doesn't matter what her intentions are. It is very likely going to get the hackles up of that person that they're speaking to. And that's part of the reason why that moment is as significant as it is. You highlighted the "and." Abigail suddenly realizes that she's putting her foot in it, even though she doesn't necessarily understand why. And we'll talk a little bit more about her experience with those kinds of conversations when we get into chapter 14 and hear a little bit more about the only other black person that she's ever spoken with, which is Nathan back at Weirwood. But yeah, I didn't necessarily notice this the first time that I read this story, and it may just be because I ran over the top of it very quickly myself, or it may be because I hadn't gotten to that point in unpacking my own white privilege, and in terms of the conversations that we have between white America and black America, no matter how close you may be to individual people. So it's a big thing, and the second I saw it, that immediately went to the top of the list of something that needed to be talked about, because it deliberately made me cringe. The way I understand it, Alex deliberately put that in there because he highlighted it the way he did in order to signify that this was significant, even though the story didn't necessarily go out of its way to explain that particular point. That's the reason I'm explaining it now. That's the big thing in all of that point salad that you talked about with the conversation. A couple other things. I think it's also important to point out that while Annie had misgivings about having Abigail take the lead in this conversation, by the same token, Annie is doing what she said that she would by giving her the chance to be leader and make these decisions for herself. And Abigail does take that to heart, because the very first conversational tactic that Abigail uses successfully is she is attempting to talk to Mary as a fellow leader. That point actually very well hits home and was a good decision. We don't necessarily know how much experience Mary has had with being a leader, whereas Abigail has had an experience of all of a couple of hours. Obviously, this is not quite correct. There is every indication that she was also a leader at Weirwood, but those were also very different circumstances. There, not only did Abigail's authority stem from Catherine to an extent, but she also had 10 years to develop relationships with a limited group of people. We don't know how long Samson has been leading her group, but it's definitely long enough to establish some firm ties, as we discussed last time with men taking the initiative based on their loyalty to her. Either way, the significance is that Samson is operating from a place of confidence, where Abby is not.
You can see why this tactic would work, because up till now, I think, you know, as we discussed last time, there are people who really do look to Mary and respect her. But up to this point, the only other sort of leader, quote unquote, or person of high rank that she's had to contend with has undermined her and failed to recognize her position of authority and is trying
insulted
to kind of
her.
Yeah, and insulted her. So to have someone who really does appreciate her responsibility and the weight of that responsibility, I think does resonate with her.
Yeah.
So it is a wise tactic to deploy, but carry on.
Well, the other counterpoint to that, and Annie goes out of her way to say that at the end of the chapter as well, is that while Abigail took an awful risk in revealing something that could have had fallout in revealing Arlington's identity, because who knows who else might have been listening, or who knows who Mary might tell after the fact, Annie goes on to say that she doesn't necessarily think that she could have done a better job at convincing Mary yea or nay. Like, it could have gone either way. And we know that Annie is speaking the complete truth, not just because we know that about how Annie purports herself to other people, but this was one of the very first things that Annie said in introducing herself to us all the way back in Chapter 6, the original beginning of Secret Rooms, where she thinks on all of the mistakes that she's made along the way and how things might have gone in an alternate reality where she did find the right thing to say. So, yeah, there are definitely two things at play here, one of which being that Abigail did things that Annie herself might not necessarily have done, but Annie would not have been sure that she could have attained success either.
There are a lot of conversations in Secret Rooms that I think the characters within the narrative put a lot of thought into and think about what they did say or what they didn't say and how things may or may not have gone differently. And it goes back to the first chapter where James is sort of analyzing how his father conducts himself in conversations, which is how he'll choose to end them and whether he recognizes the other person as an equal, and the conversation that he had with Catherine, and fast forwarding the conversation that Annie conducted with Virgil and Carl. I think this is another one where the characters are continuing to question the choices they make, and I think it's important to bear that in mind moving forward.
I've had plenty of conversations about the importance of communication in my own life. This delves a little bit into person-to-person conversation, but it's also applicable when we're talking about narrator-to-audience conversation. In any communication, there are many different levels that you are not necessarily going to have control over. And that's why you need to take these things into account, especially during important communications such as diplomatic contact like this, or trying to convince somebody in an argument like this. I could be navel-gazy here and go into way too much detail as far as this is concerned. Let me just try to hit the highlights of it. One of the things brought up all the way back during our conversation for Let Them Go is the idea in life, but also in narrative fiction, that you can do everything right and still fail. Here is another great example of that, where Abigail is doing her best to be true to herself, but she still does not succeed. And so therefore, highlighting that is, I think that's a good narrative decision in any specific case, rather than stories where everything goes exactly right, or if we're doing grim, dark storytelling, everything keeps going wrong. Putting it somewhere in the middle is a better message overall.
Completely. If you don't have those moments and stories which show that you can still do things right or conduct things with the right, the best of intentions. It's this thing which can be disheartening, because you can say, why should I try at all if, like, I did everything right and it didn't make any difference? But I think that it just puts into sharp focus the importance of continuing to try, because, as Annie said in a previous chapter, even though half the time it doesn't work, half the time it does. Mm. That's what stories like this are for. And I think that tying in with the main theme of this chapter and what we're talking about in this episode is, with race relations, it is important to keep trying, even if you make mistakes, because it's so important to keep trying, even though it's hard, even though you can run into these roadblocks that are there because of your own lack of world experience, or you just simply misjudged what would resonate or what the best thing is. It's important to keep trying and to keep learning.
If you're hearing that low background noise there, listeners, that's just the Wendigo trying to get into Toby's place. It's fine.
There's a lot of them today. If I cut out at any point, you may need to get a new co-host, Greg.
don't even joke about that.
Oh, there goes one now.
Oh, goodness. That sounds like, well, we won't say his name yet.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, our listeners hate us because I keep on teasing about things that some of you know and some of you don't. All right, communication. One of the important things of communication is choosing the right words to use. And in choosing the right words to use, you have to take into account your listener. Who are they as a person? What are they like emotionally? What are they like ethnically? What is their experience like? And so therefore, you can avoid using certain terms of phrase that you feel like people would respond negatively to.
And, Mayor Buck.
I'm sorry, what?
Mayor Buck.
Oh, God. Yeah, you said it too fast. Okay, now I understand.
All right, we'll cut that. Sorry.
We'll fix it and edit. It's fine. Yeah, because Mayor Buck does not – that's going to be part of a later conversation. Mayor Buck says everything the second he thinks it and does not care at all how people respond. Or he does care, but only after the fact. He is bluntly honest, and unfortunately the things that he's bluntly honest about is that he's a goddamn bigot. Of all stripes. And yeah, these are just the noises we make. It's fine.
It's fine.
But
it's not fine.
No, it's not. What we take away from this is that Abigail is doing her best to, as mentioned before, she's doing her best to tailor her approach to who it is she's talking to. So she tries to appeal to her as a leader. She tries to appeal to her as a woman, and she tries to appeal to her as understanding of her experience as a black woman. The point is, you can do all of the work you can in order to avoid offending, in order to be convincing, but you cannot control how people are going to respond to what you say. And on some level, you sort of have to accept that, because in spite of all the things that you may know or may be able to discern about a person, you cannot control what instinctive connections they are going to make to what you say and how you say it, which is part of the reason why the way Mary chooses to follow up on Abigail's revelation that Thomas Arlington is a former black slave, she then starts relating her experience of being a slave, being raped by her owner, and her later experience with her husband, who the implication is that he himself was a slave and yet could not stop himself from visiting the same violence that he experienced when he was powerless upon Mary and their children. There is no way that Abigail could have predicted that, even necessarily with more information. So that overall just makes that particular, I don't want to say failure again, because we don't necessarily know that this argument was winnable. But now that we know the full context of it, it just sort of makes the whole situation even more tragic.
Hmm. It's a response rather than a failure, I think. And it's, I'm trying to come up with some sort of response myself that isn't just a very deep and weary sigh. But I think it is the sort of thing that it's important for Abigail to have heard that story, because it shows why Mary, she is aware of how these cycles of abuse and violence repeat themselves. Mm. And I think that she kind of wants to maybe, she doesn't know anything about Abigail's past. And so it's this sort of thing where it's almost, she doesn't necessarily say this with a tone of, I know this and you don't. It's just a simple fact that she, it's important for her to say this. And like, Abigail doesn't necessarily factor into the equation here. It's just important that she says this to her.
Yeah.
And because of that, it creates this moment where, as you say, Abigail couldn't know any of this. So hearing it is this sort of response that she couldn't anticipate. And yet it becomes this moment of connection between the two, where it's almost odd, because in one way you could read the situation as she wanted to tell this to Abigail because, don't you tell me this stuff, because this story I'm about to tell you will explain why I have this mistrust for people in positions of authority, people who have known violence themselves. But Abigail did share something that she didn't have to share. And then it almost becomes a moment where Mary decides, I'm going to share something with you as well. And that is going to be very important for you as you go forward, because, and this is me inferring a lot about her character, this could not have been on her mind, but I think whether it's on the mind of the character, the mind of the author, or just simply one of many ways a reader or listener can read the scene, I think it has this effect that this is an important moment for Abigail to hear this story so that she can move forward and know that some people have known these terrible circumstances, and some circumstances are going to be terrible in ways she couldn't imagine. And so not everyone is going to hear this news and take it in the same way that she and Catherine and the people of Werewood did, because they will have their own history, their own baggage, their own just life of experience. And she's going to have to bear that in mind as she goes forward. To bring it back to what you were saying, you can do everything right. You can acknowledge someone and think of them with every point of consideration you can muster, but you have to acknowledge that you do not know that person and what they have been through. So all you can do is to try your best, learn from each experience, and let them make their own decision.
I like that interpretation a great deal, where Mary is acknowledging that Abigail has put herself out there and taken a risk, and without saying it, Mary's response is, I can't give you what you want, but not for nothing, here's something you can take with you. I like that she is at the very least recognizing what Abigail was trying to do and give her something in recompense, even if it's not the answer that she wanted.
I think that it's not a spoiler to say that this is, to some extent, an unresolved thread that will be on Abigail's mind for some time. And so because of that, we don't know everything about Mary, because she is to Abigail this unknown person, someone who she will think about because she didn't know everything. And so you have to kind of read a lot into this, but it is this sort of fleeting moment of contact which you will wonder, did Abigail do the right thing? Did she not? It's something which you see Mary and you recognize her strengths, but you also wonder what else there is there, because clearly there's so much more to her than what you can tell from the surface. It's what makes her a compelling character for as little time as we know her.
Yeah. As a final coda, way back when I first led into the topic of communication, I alluded to past experiences where I bungled what I had to say, and those moments led to hurt feelings or wounded relationships. There have also been times where it's been me that was unable to hear what someone else was saying, and therefore I was the one that reacted poorly. All things considered, Mary's reaction was quite even-handed. It could have gone a lot worse. Even more difficult is when you aren't involved at all, but you can see that two people are talking past each other, neither able to hear what the other has to say, or at the very least, unable to manage their own emotional response. That can be painful when you are invested in that relationship remaining stable, and it's happened more than once in recent memory where I found out after the fact of a major emotional blow-up between two people I cared about and felt paralyzed to do anything about. You don't know how to be emotionally present for those people without taking sides in the argument. I understand from personal experience that very often our response can be fueled by trauma, and we don't ever want to discount that. It can also be the result of just having too few spoons to deal with things as a result of depression, anxiety, pain, world weariness, or all of the above. In an ideal world, we can respond to all disagreements logically and come to an accord. But we live in this one, where even without the problems of bad faith actors or bigotry, even good people can have emotional conflict that is really no one's fault. We all need to take responsibility for our own words. If you've hurt someone, the best thing to try to do is understand why they were hurt and to make amends if you can. This is one of the reasons why the comment, "I'm sorry if you were offended," is so infuriating. Empathy for others should be the default, but that also involves work and willingness to admit that you made a mistake. And not everyone is willing to do that, especially if we are angry because it feels like we weren't hurt either. And while we are more willing to put in the work for a relationship that matters to us, it feels especially true right now that we are all running with a low gas tank thanks to current events. We can't always know what will set others off. But when dealing with especially divisive issues, taking the extra time to consider your words is the best plan of action. And if people have strong reactions, you should try to process those reactions before responding. It may help avoid future damage. Just briefly, listeners, I wanted to get a black man or a black woman that was also a fan of New Century to come in and discuss these things. The stuff that happens in Chapter 13, the stuff that happens in Chapter 14. I was unable to do so. I could have put more effort into it, I'll be honest with you, but I was thinking about time factors, and on top of that, this is just going to be the beginning of our discussion about race relations as pertains to the modern world and as pertains to the world of New Century, but it will become much more important by the time we get to Arlington.
It's so important for us to call us on our bullshit if we are stumbling, if we're doing anything. You know, we're very much like Abigail. We will be trying our best, but if there is a point where we just put our foot in our mouth or anything like that, and we're giving every effort not to, but do call us on our bullshit and do like come forward, because we have always wanted this project of ours to expand outwards and to like add more voices to the discussion. So we acknowledge that our perspective on this are two voices in a room, and if you think that we're missing the mark in a serious way that needs addressing, please do get in touch, and we would love to have you on.
Yeah, most importantly, Arlington is actually going to be a long way off in the timeline. We were discussing this the other day, immediately after talking about secret rooms. Next on the docket is going to be The Cartographer's Handbook, and due to the nature of how that book is structured, that is actually going to go a lot quicker than the ones that we've done so far. And then immediately after that, even though in terms of story-wise, the natural continuation on from Secret Rooms and The Cartographer's Handbook is Arlington, the two of us really, really want to talk about Tiger's Eye.
Oh, we really do.
So in the meantime, that means that anybody that is listening to this, if you want to come on to our podcast for one session or multiple sessions to bring more voices specifically to Arlington so that we can do this right from the go rather than have to apologize or re-explain for stuff that we messed up along the way, please, please get in touch with us. I will go through whatever extra bureaucracy or hoops I have to go through in order to bring you onto this, please. As some people may be aware by now, we changed up our plans slightly. In terms of overall timeline of content, interviews with cast members will sometimes run concurrently with normal episodes, and will sometimes run in place of normal episodes, depending on whatever I'm dealing with at the time. The rest of our coverage of Secret Rooms will come out over the next 3 months, but after that, we will be jumping immediately to Tiger's Eye. With everything else that is going on, Cartographer's Handbook just felt too heavy to cover at the time. It actually dovetails just fine with the content of Arlington, because as longtime readers will know, part of that story is how the second printing of the handbook came to be, which is the version that is the published novel that Alex wrote in 2013. So, the appeal is still out there, and I will send out another call via Twitter and Discord for voices besides ours when that time comes. I don't want to make it sound like I am asking black people to school us on these matters, as doing the work is our job as content creators, and people trying to be the best versions of ourselves. But it is always better to have the voice of a lived experience, rather than speaking for others, as that can translate into speaking over others. All right. Appeal made. Is there any other aspects that we want to talk about in terms of specifically Mary's conversation with Abigail, do you think?
Nothing that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of the other notes on this list here are specifically going to be more relevant to Nathan in chapter 14. So with that, we've talked about race relations. Now let's talk about the coronavirus. Or rather, let's not, because just having got done with one heavy topic, this is a great time to take a break and leave the rest for next time. I already knew that this episode was going to be a tough one, and to be honest, I feel like if I followed my normal modus operandi and tried to find thematic music, it would just bring down the mood further. So instead, I'm breaking out a purely instrumental piece that I've been saving. Geeks or other people that are also a full-time internet like myself may already be aware of Lindsay Sterling, a violinist that I first became aware of because she dressed up like Link and did a violin medley of the most notable pieces from the various Legend of Zelda games. She has collaborated with other musicians since, like Two Cellos, Peter Hollins, Pentatonix, and even Amy Lee of Evanescence. But this is an original piece that I not only love the music of, but has an amazing Western-style video to go with it.
It will get your toes tapping and definitely lift your spirits when you need it. I give you Roundtable Rival.